to the Security Perimeter Podcast, an island of insanity, starring my dad, Athanasios Christoulos. This is an amazing podcast, really the best. You're gonna love this, guaranteed, 100%. We are gonna make podcasting great again, promise. And now, my dad, Athanasios, aka Saki Christoulos.
Yeah. So Tony Pan, welcome to the Security Perimeter Podcast. Thanks for being with us today.
My pleasure. Thanks for the invitation to talk to you.
So Tony is a professor at Rice University. He has written quite a bit on issues related to security and specifically on the border between Mexico and the United States. Tony and I met, I guess, about 10 years ago, right?
When
I invited Tony to come down to Mexico so we can do something on North American security, and Tony was at UTEP at the University of Texas in El Paso, and then he made the big move to Houston at Rice. So Tony, this is a pretty relaxed podcast. I mean, we do try to go a little bit more in depth on the issues than, let's say, you would ordinarily hear on news and even on, you know, like good news and stuff like that. But it is relaxed. So not that it's R-rated or anything like that. So, feel free to pretty much use as much colorful language as you think might be appropriate. And if it's a little too colorful, then I'll edit it out afterwards. So I invited Tony specifically to talk about the issue of the border between the United States and Mexico, because it's such a issue right now, especially with the whole thing about the wall. Let me ask you something. You lived along the border and you know quite a bit about the border. Forgetting whether or not the border wall is going to actually make a difference, but is the border as dangerous as everyone says or thinks it is?
No, not really. I think that most of us would actually agree that the U.S.-Mexico border is not that dangerous. By almost any measure, the U.S.-Mexico border is actually quite safe, and it's very well guarded and very well regulated as to who crosses and who doesn't. One of the most important things that politicians like to cite, especially those who are against the border wall, like Beto O'Rourke, who's running for the Senate in Texas and has represented El Paso in Washington for quite a while, is the fact that border cities tend to be among the safest in the United States. If you look at crime rates and murder rates in places like El Paso, Nogales, Calexico, Laredo, Texas, Brownsville, they're among the lowest. El Paso itself, which is about a mid-sized city, has been labeled by the FBI first, second, and third most secure or safest city in the country. These are not, I think, trivial measures. People in El Paso who walk at 2-3 in the morning downtown feel very, very safe. There are places in the United States where you definitely do not feel safe. Here in Houston, for example, there are places that you would not want to go at midnight. And yet, the border has this image that it's unsafe, that there's all kinds of lawlessness, and that there's all kinds of crime going on. It's not the case, I think. What we have to understand is that even in the middle of the height of the criminal activity in Ciudad Juarez and Tijuana, when the murder rates were exploding, the U.S. cities remained relatively safe. And that means that the motivation, the political motivation, the rhetorical motivation to portray the U.S. border cities as lawless. For example, the former governor of Texas, Rick Perry, who said that a car bomb had gone off downtown El Paso, which was not accurate at all.
I don't remember him saying that. When did he say that?
Yeah, in 2010, there was a car bomb that went off in on Avenida 16 de Septiembre in Juarez, and it killed a couple of people. And he said that it had gone off in El Paso, downtown El Paso. Huh. But later, of course, he took his words back. But I think that there's so much political, electoral motivation. And I think no one understands that better than President Trump, who definitely portrayed the border as an incredibly lawless place. And such is not the case. Most of the criminal activity that takes place on the border today is very well gated and very well administered, and very well, I think, controlled. There are very few places where immigrants are coming through. They're still coming through in South Texas. And most illegal drugs are actually crossing at ports of entry right under the noses of customs agents. Very little illegal activity goes on between ports of entry. But the border has that fame. It's had that reputation since the 1800s, and I think it hasn't really changed.
Obviously, on the other side of the border, the Mexican side, things are considerably worse. Is that right? Yeah. I mean, it's pretty obvious, right?
They are.
Juarez and so forth.
Well, you know, it's different conditions. I think what has actually failed in the case of Mexico is the institutions. You had a president, Felipe Calderón, between 2006 and 2012 in Mexico, who made an effort to confront organized crime. There is a whole debate on his presidency and the diagnosis that he made of the power and the reach of organized crime in Mexico. He obviously saw organized crime as a parallel government in many places like Tamaulipas. He thought that organized crime had gotten so powerful and had co-opted so many local and state political authorities in Mexico that it was now a threat to the Mexican state itself. And he decided to confront that. I think he may have chosen a very blunt instrument, the military, of course. He deployed the military. The military had already been deployed in rural areas throughout Mexico, of course, since the Vicente Fox administration. But Calderón made the decision to deploy the military to urban areas, and some of those urban areas that were racked by organized crime were border cities. Mm-hmm. We're talking about Tijuana and Ciudad Juarez and, of course, Laredo and Matamoros and Reynosa, the five major cities. And to all of them, President Calderón sent the military. The federal police was not ready, so he made some efforts to get the federal police in shape, and they were eventually supposed to take the place of the military. But in the meantime, the military was deployed. to these five cities, and there was a general consensus now that it was counterproductive because the organized crime indeed got disorganized. It didn't disappear. It became a little bit more disorganized. Different groups now control different parts of the Mexican border with the United States. The large cartels like Tijuana and Juarez, and even the Gulf cartel, which still exists, are very weakened, but the price was very high. There was a lot of violence. There were outright street confrontations between the military and criminals, and there were a lot of bystanders who were shot and wounded, some dead. And so it is estimated that it really constituted an instrument, a political decision by Calderon that cost the border quite a bit. Okay. But even in the midst of all that violence, the U.S. cities, their sister cities remained very safe, very secure.
Okay, but I mean, you know, taking it from the perspective of an American president, right? And I understand what you're saying. You're saying on the U.S. side, things are pretty good. On the Mexican side, things are nasty, and if drugs are coming over, they're coming over points of entry which are official, right? Yeah. So, you know, given the given the what's been coming out of the news over the last decade with respect to what's going on in Mexico, isn't it kind of like, I'm the last person to defend Trump, right? But isn't it kind of understandable that there would be some kinds of demands on the part of U.S. public opinion to do something about the problem in Mexico, so to speak, even though it may not necessarily be causing all the trouble that Trump and his supporters are claiming that it's causing? It is a pretty nasty... I mean, Mexico is in a pretty nasty situation right now. You know, the way I look at it, and this is something that I've told to a number of Mexican policymakers, you know, this whole thing about the border, and let's not play victims here, because the border has been a problem for, like you said, centuries, but let's say 40 years, right? And we've had a number of opportunities to make a lot of progress with respect to making the border smarter, maybe not necessarily safer, but making it a smarter border, like they did in the case of Canada and the United States. And we kind of missed those opportunities. And it's not only because of the Mexicans, also, obviously, but, you know, the Americans have something to do with that as well. I don't know. I think what I'm trying to say is that are we so surprised that the issue of the border... Or should we be so surprised that the issue of the border has now become politicized in the manner that it has?
Not at all. I think you're absolutely right. The American public has the right to demand that its politicians do something about the border. I mean, the border has been the source of, really the transit point for American purposes, the source of undocumented migration, which was rampant in the 1980s and 90s and even into 2007 or so. And it's also been the source of illegal drugs, lots and lots of them. The illegal drug landscape is changing very quickly, obviously, even in the United States with the legalization of marijuana and the opioid crisis, which is often blamed on opioids coming from abroad, but really... A lot of it has to do with legal medicine, just medication in the United States. And so, yes, they have a right to demand that the U.S.-Mexico do something, and politicians have a particular olfactory sense that's very attuned to that. And Trump certainly has been quite aware of these demands. I think that it's a philosophical issue to some extent. You know, I think that if there is one thing that characterizes the United States, culturally speaking, the political culture of the United States is law and order, not compassion, not sympathy, not generosity, not freedom, not liberty. It's law and order. It's always been like that. And so if there is one thing that Americans truly, truly fear is lawlessness and disorder. And the border has been a symbol for lawlessness and disorder. So there is a legitimate political demand, and there are politicians who take advantage of that. There is also a problem in Mexico, and indeed I don't put Mexico in the position of a victim. The Mexican authorities have actually been quite neglectful of their own duties to provide safety and security and institutions that actually work. The difference between Canada and Mexico, as you were pointing out, is that Americans tend to trust Canadians, not because they are Canadians or speak English, French, but because they have the right kinds of institutions that have interoperability American institutions.
That's exactly it, yeah.
That they can work together, they trust them, they trust that their system is honest, it's secure, that they can share intelligence and they can work together with them, and they can make a lot of their law enforcement regulations compatible. That's not the case with Mexico. Mexico right. has really rickety, dysfunctional institutions, and I think if we truly, truly want a different kind of border management system, if Mexico really, really wants the Americans to help create a binational border management system where both work together to figure out how to build a smart border that will work for everyone, mm-hmm. there is a prerequisite, and that is to fix Mexican institutions. Yeah. The greatest, I think, challenge for the next president of Mexico, whoever that may be, is to forget about pushing structural reforms that have to do with the economy. The number one structural reform that Mexico needs today, if it truly wants to be a developed country and a country that can appeal to the United States to create a binational management system for the border, is to fix its rule of law institutions, broadly speaking.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it's not even a question of money, Tony. My sense is that it has a lot more to do with political will, or a lack of political will. In my personal experiences with some of these authorities, when we talk about things they can do, the issue is never money. The issue is like, well, you know, it's a little too hard to do because of this, and it's a little hard because I can't do this, and that guy's not going to let me do it. So it's this. I wouldn't even say it's corruption. Of course, corruption is a problem, but it's a lack of political will on the part of the actors or the players or the decision makers who are making the decisions on these kinds of things. And if they would make these kinds of changes, I think a positive outcome at a minimum would be that at least some corruption, for example, would be dealt with.
I think beyond political will, because I think political will is something that can come easily. You know, if the conditions are right, I think there may be political will. Obviously, there was a lot of political will early in the Peña administration because they gathered the main political parties together. They put together a pact, the mm-hmm. Pact of Mexico, and they were able to push a number, almost a dozen, important reforms that are going to really make a difference in Mexico over time. It depends on the implementation, and Mexico, you know, it's a typical country where implementation is always where the difficulty is. It's not about the laws, but the implementation itself. But I would say that added to the problem of political will is lack of political imagination. Mm. I've been thinking about the fact that we need a book. You know, we need to work on the concept of the failure of leadership. Mm-hmm. Leaders are failing, and everywhere from Hungary to the Philippines to Turkey to Great Britain to the United States to Mexico, right? And so what we see today is leaders that may or may not have the political will, may think about it or not, but are simply not willing to make the tough decisions and putting the hard work that is required to solve these major issues. And in the case of Mexico, I also see a political class that has very little imagination, very little creativity, that cannot think strategically, cannot think big, and figure out how to solve these issues.
Yeah,
it's not important to them. Not important.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was going to say, and add to that, perverse incentives. So you got a deadly mix here.
Yeah, it's a number of issues that we need to really fix. I mean, I guess in the case of Mexico, you have to go back to the 1930s to 1970s when there was a national leadership who understood roughly what the national interest was, rightly or wrongly, socialist or not, a mix of systems, a state-led economy, however you want to put it. But clearly Mexico had a vision for itself. And the primary point of departure was development, national development, economic development. And so they had this vision. That vision was lost in the 1980s, and it created vacuums, important vacuums, economic and political, and vacuums in leadership that very quickly were filled in by more perverse, darker actors, not the least of which is criminal organizations. I mean, the 80s are really the decade where a lot of these criminal organizations were incubated in Mexico and were consolidated and took the path that we know they had up until the Calderon administration. Now there's a different pattern, obviously. Mexico is racked not by four major cartels, but by 320 or so smaller organizations that operate in barrios and small towns and cities and roads and rural areas. Mm-hmm. So it's a different landscape today, but I think the leadership itself got lost. And also, there is a revolving door, I think, between the economic elites and the political elites. It's kind of always been there, but at least in the past, the economics was subjugated to the political goals of the country. And now, elites have essentially kind of hijacked the state, push the reforms that are good for business, and forgotten that a developed country requires much more than economic structural reforms. Again, we go back to the issue of the rule of law, we go back to the issue of the federal police, we go back to the issue of federalism, we go back to the issue of political competition between governors and the state. You know, right now, for example, you have the governor of Tamaulipas, Garcia Cabeza de Vaca, who's been trying to figure out how to work with civil society, with the federal government, with local government, in solving the security problems of a border state, which is a very important border state. When I have gotten to talk to the governor of Tamaulipas twice in a kind of an hour and a half conversation, he has made it very clear that he's got important economic plans for Tamaulipas. We know that Tamaulipas, for example, is important to the shale industry, the future of the shale industry in Mexico. It's got the largest known shale reserves in Mexico. We know that it is the route for most of the Central American migrants today. We know that it shares 400 miles of border with the United States, and the most important inland port in North America, which is Laredo, Nuevo Laredo, a lot of trade. We know that it faces the Northern Gulf, which are some of the richest oil reserves, water oil reserves in the northern part of the Gulf that belongs to Mexico, and a potential for one of the most important ports, Tampico, and a potential for a really important port in Matamoros. So this is a very important state. And yet, what is the number one problem that the governor of Tamaulipas is facing today? Security. The inability of the institutions to truly, truly tackle crime. He knows that there are groups that control Tampico and Victoria and Matamoros and Reynosa. The Laredo group is a different group, and it's right now kind of quiet. Most of the violence is concentrated in Reynosa, the border town across from McAllen, Texas, and of course in Tampico and Victoria. And he knows who these groups are, but his ability, the state police, the resources, the coordination with the military, with the federal government is just not there. So the institutions themselves are preventing his political will from actually being able to fight these groups. And then you got some dilemmas, for example, in the case of the border between Tamaulipas and Veracruz, you got a particular group that controls the Tampico port, this criminal group that extorts money from all the taxi drivers in the city and all kinds of things like that. And he knows that he can take them out potentially, you know, can make an effort. It'll be bloody, but he can do it. And yet the Cartel Jalisco Nueva Generacion, this Jalisco cartel that is now the strongest criminal group in Mexico, is just over the border in Veracruz and waiting for the opportunity to move into Tamaulipas. And so he said, I may later have a bigger problem if I take this guy out. So you face these kinds of dilemmas as a political leader trying to solve these security issues. And this is where I see that the institutions in Mexico, even the political institutions, are not really prepared to do the very hard work that needs to be done. And as long as that is the case, I think the United States will never have trust in Mexico as a true partner to manage the border differently. And the solution is going to be what essentially Trump proposes, which is a wall. And forget the physical wall. We're talking about a wall that means less mobility, less trade, less interaction, less crossings, essentially just freezing the border because there's so much fear to what is going on in Mexico.
Okay, well, you mentioned the wall, so why don't we go into that? Could you tell us a little bit about what are the problems with the wall, both in terms of whether or not it'll be able to deal with the problem, deal with the bad hombres, as Trump says, but also some of the political problems Trump is having in the United States in trying to actually get the wall itself built.
And before Tony answers that question, we'll just take a little quick break to listen to something that came out of the end of the Second World War while Americans, among others, are occupying Germany. Some of you might actually agree with what this broadcaster is saying.
The problem now is future peace. That is your job in Germany. By your conduct and attitude while on guard inside Germany, you can lay the groundwork of a peace that could last forever. Or just the opposite. You could lay the groundwork for a new war to come. And just as American soldiers had to do this job 26 years ago, so other American soldiers, your sons, might have to do it again another 20-odd years from now. Germany today appears to be beaten. Hitler, out. Swastikas, gone. Nazi propaganda, off the air. Concentration camps, empty. You'll see ruins. You'll see flowers. You'll see some mighty pretty scenery. Don't let it fool you. You are in enemy country. Be alert. Suspicious of everyone. Take no chances. You are up against something more than tourist scenery. You are up against German history. It isn't good. This book was written chapter by chapter, not by one man, not by one Führer. It was written by the German people. The next war, that is why you occupy Germany. To make that next war impossible. No easy job. In battle, you kept your wits about you. Don't relax that caution now. The Nazi party may be gone. The Nazi thinking, Nazi training, and Nazi trickery remain. The German lust for conquest is not dead. It's merely gone undercover. Somewhere in this Germany are the SS guards, the Schutzstaffel, the Gestapo gangsters. Out of uniform, you won't know them, but they'll know you. Somewhere in this Germany are stormtroopers by the thousands. Out of sight, part of the mob, but still watching you and hating you. Somewhere in this Germany, there are 2 million ex-Nazi officials. Out of power, but still in there. And thinking. Thinking about next time. Remember that only yesterday, every business, every profession was part of Hitler's system. The doctors, technicians, clockmakers, postmen, farmers, housekeepers, toy makers, barbers, cooks, dock workers. Practically every German was part of the Nazi network. Guard particularly against this group. These are the most dangerous. German youth. Children when the Nazi Party came into power. They know no other system than the one that poisoned their minds. They're soaked in it. Trained to win by cheating. Trained to pick on the weak. They've heard no free speech. Read no free press. They were brought up on straight propaganda. Products of the worst educational crime in the entire history of the world. Practically everything you believe in, they have been trained to hate and destroy. They believe they were born to be masters, that we are inferiors, designed to be their slaves. They may deny it now, but they believe it, and will try to prove it again. Don't argue with them. Don't try to change their point of view. Other Allied representatives will concern themselves with that. You are not being sent into Germany as educators. You are soldiers on guard. You will observe their local laws, respect their customs and religion, and you will respect their property rights. You will not ridicule them. You will not argue with them. You will not be friendly. You will be aloof, watchful, and suspicious. Every German is a potential source of trouble.
Yeah, this is a very interesting topic, what is going on with the wall. Well, the Trump administration itself knows that it made a big promise to build the wall, whatever that is, and it wants to push through, and some money has been appropriated for these models. There was a call for proposals, and some companies are participating in this, and they're kind of trying to design different kinds of walls, some of them inclined, and some of them a lot higher, and some of them thicker, and some of them deeper, and some concrete, and some a combination of materials. So there's right now this crazy run, because there is anywhere between $25 to $50 billion to be made from building the wall. So right now we're in the very conceptualization stages of the wall, but the Trump administration is going to face a couple of things. One, political opposition, which in some ways it's from the Democrats, but also from a lot of Republicans from the border states who may have doubts that this is the best way to resolve border flows, especially illegal border flows. They know that a lot of the drugs, 85%, cross at ports of entry. So the wall is essentially ineffective.
So hold on a second. I just want to make that clear. So 85% of drugs that enter from Mexico into the United States are actually coming through border points. I mean, official transit points, points where there are officers on the U.S. side revising and checking cars and stuff like that?
Yeah, that's correct.
Well, how does that happen?
Exactly. We know that, for example, only 1% of all trucks are inspected. You have a place like Nuevo Laredo, Laredo, Texas, where 7 million trucks cross every year. There is absolutely no way that you can, even with all the technology, the smart gamma rays and the machines and the detectors, that you can know everything that is hidden in those trucks. Mm-hmm. The same thing happens in San Diego, El Paso. The kind of traffic that occurs between Mexico and the United States is just the volume the sheer volume is so enormous that you can only check a very tiny percentage of all trucks. And yes, I mean, I've been to these ports of entry, and they show you how the drugs are crossed, you know, and they have like practically a museum there. You can see some wax statues that are cut in half, and you can see the hollow spaces in those things. You can, they cross them in furniture, they cross them in cans, they cross them hidden in containers within the vehicle itself, kind of double floors and compartments and so on. Most of them are actually at ports of entry, and even then it's becoming even more focalized and more intense, because marijuana is now legal in most states in the United States. Mm-hmm. And Mexican marijuana is no longer that desirable. I think the marijuana business for Mexico is collapsing. Marijuana for Mexico was never really that good or that strong or that powerful or whatever. A lot of people that know this very well and that are kind of connoisseurs of marijuana will tell you that, you know, marijuana for Mexico was always kind of weak. But they, you know, in California, they're now doing all kinds of experimentation with these plants and the THC content and so on. So clearly that is changing. And what is coming from Mexico today is essentially heroin and cocaine from South America. A lot of it now is coming through Central America and even the Caribbean. And then, of course, you got methamphetamines and those kinds of confection drugs. So they're still coming. They're smaller. They're very easy to hide, and CBP is simply overwhelmed. They cannot inspect all that. And everybody, even the DEA and CBP, they will all recognize that most of the drugs cross at ports of entry. So the wall is essentially useless against drug trafficking. You need a different setup for that. Like you said, you need smart borders, and you need trust, and you need operations that go well beyond the border. Cooperation that extends deep into the U.S. and deep into Mexico, mm-hmm. but that also requires trust, mm-hmm. and it requires compatible institutions, and it requires interoperability, and those things do not currently exist. They're going to have to be built, and it will take probably a very long time.
Okay, sorry. So go back to, I took you off topic. You were telling us about the wall and about how certain governors and congressmen from border states oppose it.
Yeah, and I think there are some other contradictions. President Trump, for example, has just proposed a major tax cut. His plan is short on details, but it is estimated that it will cost $4 trillion to the U.S. government. In other words, over a certain period of time, he will return $4 trillion to mostly the wealthiest and corporations in the United States.
Yeah, this is with a tax cut, not the cost of the wall.
It's really a tax cut. That's what it is. So that will open a huge budget hole in the U.S. Federal expenditures. And I'm not sure how he's going to make it up. And so on the one hand, he's doing that. On the other hand, he's asking for $1 trillion in infrastructure investments, and he's asking for $25 to $50 billion to build a wall, and then he's asking for 20,000 more CBP Border Patrol and ICE agents. Mm-hmm. So he's ramping up the expenditures, and he is at the same time lowering the intake of taxes. So that is a contradiction that is probably not going to go well in Congress, and he will eventually have to demonstrate how exactly he's going to pay for the wall, because Mexico is not likely to pay for the wall. And so that is going to be a political battle that we may see in the next few months. And then the other thing about,
you know, the thing is that he's just way too distracted with other stuff right now to think about the wall right this particular moment. I mean, every time he tries to talk about the wall, something else comes up. If it isn't North Korea, it's NFL players. And I think that may have something to do with it as well, that he just can't stay focused. If he wants to do this thing, there has to be some kind of concerted effort on the part of his administration to push this through. But I just don't see it happening.
I think that President Trump has probably attention deficit disorder. He goes almost like a hummingbird from one flower to the next. He is a man that is in great need of reaffirmation. We saw it in Alabama with the players that you were talking about, the players that kneeled to protest discrimination against African Americans and police brutality. And when he says something and the crowd roars, he doubles down on it. And he likes that kind of attention. And so whatever gives him attention, whatever feeds his need to be a central figure in the debate, he will pay attention. And whatever requires him to really sit down, think through things, debate, look at data, analyze, conceptualize issues, and figure out solutions, he just doesn't have the discipline and the attention span for that. And I think the wall is that. But he does know that he has to fulfill part of it. And I think this is the reason why he held DACA hostage. DACA is the program that that allowed 800,000 young people who were brought to the United States without documents to stay in the United States on a two-year basis. Every 2 years they have to apply. And so he decided to eliminate that program. And I think it was essentially a ploy. Holding that program hostage was a ploy to force Congress to give him at least an installment on the wall. I'm almost convinced that that is going to be the trade-off. And if the Democrats want to save these 800,000 kids, well, now young people up to 30
adults,
years old, they're going to have to say, well, here's also $5 billion for the wall so that you can begin the building. And then he can go on to the next election and say, my promise has been fulfilled. It's a political calculation that unfortunately can cause a lot of pain to these young people if between now and March, DACA is not saved by Congress and if he doesn't get what he wants.
He's having a lot of trouble in Congress just all around, right? Even with health care and do you think this the wall's actually going to get built then? You know, given the things that you've just run through with budgetary issues and political opposition among congressmen and governors in the South and so forth?
Well, I think that we have to remember that there's already about 650 miles of fencing. In some places it's a fence, in some places it's a wall, in some places it's metal, in some places it's a chain link fence, in some places. So there's already kind of the easiest part to build a wall is in New Mexico, Arizona, and California. And that's where most of the fencing is located today.
Right.
That's federal land, except for the Tohono O'odham Reservation between Arizona and Sonora, which is tribal lands. And the Tohono O'odham tribes are very opposed to building a border wall because they live between Arizona and Sonora, and they move back and forth, and they have their festivals and their, you know, the rituals on both sides. But most of it is really federal land, and so it's easy to build it. They can do it, I think. But that's already built. That's already there.
Yeah.
Most of the immigration through Arizona and New Mexico and California is already nearly zero.
Mm-hmm.
So the building of the wall on those – and also they're very straight lines, right? There's a straight line between California and Baja California, a straight line between Sonora and Arizona, and there's a straight line between New Mexico and Chihuahua. So,
and it's pretty flat.
And it's pretty flat. It's very easy to build a wall. Most of the fencing is already there. So they can replace that fencing for some beautiful concrete wall or whatever the concept is. The problem is Texas. Texas is about 60% of the U.S.-Mexico border. It's 1,200 miles out of 2,000 miles. So most of it is really in Texas, and of course we know there's a river. And walling a river, around a river, through a river, in the middle of a river, in the floodplains of a river, is a very complicated, technically, in terms of engineering, in terms of maintenance, is a very complicated place. And also most of the land along the Texas, the Rio Grande, which is the Texas border with Mexico, is private land. And we've seen already a play out of the kinds of lawsuits and stays by federal courts and the waiving of environmental laws and the complications, the legal, social complications that can emerge on private lands. Because there's already some fencing in Texas. And so what happens is you end up with a very curious type of fencing, presumably walling if the wall is built, where the wall meanders around private properties, behind certain areas, having to be put as far as 5 to 10 miles north of the river, having to skirt certain floodplains. And when you approach the delta by Tamaulipas in Texas, obviously you can't put a wall right on the delta. It's the terrain is not easy to build on. There's a lot of water, wetlands. It's a very complicated premise. And so in Texas, this is going to be a very complicated issue.
And presumably very expensive.
Exactly. And this is why I'm not sure why they say that it will take $26 billion. Honestly, I think it's a miscalculation because I think they're saying, okay, how much is it to build a wall of these characteristics per mile? And they may say it takes, you know, $25 million a mile to build a wall of these characteristics, this deep, this high, this wide, this thick. But that assumes that the terrain itself is homogeneous, that you find the same type of terrain everywhere, that it's flat and so on. That's not the case. You know, costs go up depending on the type of terrain. And so I think that there will be a lot of complications in Texas. He doesn't have the time to build that kind of wall. But to remember, the 650 miles of wall fencing that already exist have taken since 1994, when the first type of fencing went up in California. So we're talking, 23 years ago. So it took that long to go 650 miles. There is no way they can build a 2,000-mile wall with all these complications, different terrains and issues and the costs and so on in the next 3 years that remain of his first term or potentially a second term. That's an impossible project. But it's politically popular. Like you said, you know, the Americans want law and order. And the symbol of disorder and lawlessness is the border. And so they think that a wall brings law and order.
Let's assume that he can't get it done for some reason. Is this gonna cause him a lot of gripe amongst his supporters?
I think that there is a base that President Trump has that is very hard. You see him in the rallies that he hosts in Indiana, in Alabama. We've seen it in the last few days. He draws some crowds, and they passionately love him, and they will justify almost anything that he does. This is the kind of crowd he was talking about when he said, I can go on Fifth Avenue in New York, shoot somebody in the head, and nobody would do anything to me. Yeah, so this is the kind of things that he said, and this is the kind of crowd that would forgive him. In fact, there is a student of mine here at Rice who comes from Nebraska, and she was telling me that her grandfather, who is a Trump supporter, an ardent supporter, and who knows the kinds of things that Trump has said about women and so on, and the way her grandfather justifies his unending and unbending support for Mr. Trump is by saying, well, God can use even wicked people for his designs.
Wow.
And so that means
that's a good one.
It's a powerful argument. And that means that he can do almost anything, and almost anything he does is probably some design by God.
Wow.
And so this is the kind of audience that, you know, will be with him. That's about, I think it's shrinking. That's probably a good 30% of the U.S. electorate.
Yeah, that's not going to move. The political aspect of the relationship between Mexico and the United States, it starts off really bad, of course, when Trump wins the election and some of these conversations are leaked and some of these comments are made and so forth. And where do you see the bilateral relationship now? Have things gotten better? Are they worse? I know we're in the middle of negotiating NAFTA and things aren't going as well as some people hope, but how are things bilaterally between the two countries now?
I think that Mr. Trump has a bad image of Mexico. He has no respect for Mexico. He thinks that Mexico is a country that's not worth having as a partner. And Mexico finds itself in a position that a battered wife would be in.
You don't think that's changed at all in the last year?
I don't think so. In fact, I think that this is where I'm going to say something that might sound a little controversial when it comes to Mexico, but I think it's important to say it.
Mm-hmm.
There was Mr. Videgaray, who is the foreign minister, has made some moves that are puzzling because I'm not sure if he's trying to send a message to Washington that Mexico is serious about the partnership and it's and the United States is central to Mexican foreign policy and the United States wants a relationship with the United States.
Mm.
And Mexico wants a relationship.
Yeah,
you're
right. Yeah.
Expelling the North Korean ambassador from Mexico after they exploded the thermonuclear device. That doesn't make any sense to me. I mean, it is an American problem. It's a very serious issue. It's a Japanese-South Korean issue. But I'm not sure why Mexico would take a gratuitous fight over and attract that kind of attention vis-a-vis North Korea when it's got a lot of other work to do.
It's consistent with Mexico's non-proliferation foreign policy doctrine since the 1960s. I don't see a problem, honestly, with that.
It is. But it was taken at a moment, you know, when it is the United States, when it is in the United States, high in the United States agenda. And so, to me, it's like...
Yeah, but you could kill two birds with one stone, right? You could say, yeah. I mean, I did this in the name of, you know, global non-proliferation, but wink, wink, hint, hint, I hope the Americans are happy about this decision. It's a, you know, killing two birds with one stone.
Wow. Yeah, I just think that they're misreading. Mexico is misreading the United States at this point in history. Now, to be sure, Mexico and the United States have had their ups and downs. You know, there's probably no down further down than 1846-48. In 1914, when the U.S. sent its troops to Veracruz, and probably 1985, when Kiki Camarena was killed, you know, things have been rough before, and they're probably not as rough today as they've been in the past. Both the relationship has evolved, and it's so thick that it's very difficult for Mr. Trump to just cut through it and sever it altogether. It's just not going to happen.
Mm-hmm.
But it is delicate. It requires a lot of skill. It requires a lot of really serious thought. And I think this moves, you know, like you said, you know, there may be more useful as a signal to the United States, but not necessarily for Mexico's purposes. It's not going to have any influence on the NAFTA negotiations, for example.
Of course,
and, you know, there are, and on the image that Trump has of Mexico. Trump holds Mexico in contempt. It's not a country that he is going to invest any effort in salvaging the relationship with. He doesn't have any respect for Mexico. And now, you know, I think Mexico ought to really figure out, you know, what its options are, because NAFTA is in danger and it may be gone. Now, to be honest, I think that 85% of the commercial relationship or so will remain untouched. Yeah, Mexico will go through a little crunch. There'll be some economic contraction if NAFTA ends, but most of the economic relationship will survive. Why? Because we forget that, in fact, a paper that I wrote with a colleague here at the Baker Institute three, four months ago, I think demonstrates that most of the economic relationship would actually survive the death of NAFTA.
Mm-hmm.
Why? Because the structural issues that prevent the economic relationship from advancing are already out of the way with or without NAFTA, i.e. no quotas, low border fees, and so on. And the issues, the liberalization of Mexico itself, the opportunity to invest in Mexico. So most of the relationship would survive the death of NAFTA anyway. So being so obsessed and focused on salvaging NAFTA itself puts Mexico in a weak position.
That's a good point. Yeah,
I think most of it. And then eventually companies will make their calculations anyway, both American and Mexican companies, and they will recalculate their business models. They will account for the added costs, and business will go on. So I think in that sense, I think Mexico, the pending issues that Mexico has are different, and they have to do with the rule of law. And I cannot stress enough that Mexico will never graduate into the family of liberal democracies and advanced economies if it doesn't deal with its rule of law, the very deep structural issues that it has had for centuries, and now all the attention in Mexico should turn in that direction.
All right, one last question. When you said that Trump hates Mexico, do you think it's a racial thing, or do you think it has more to do with just the whole country and maybe some of these things, the lack of rule of law and corruption and so forth? In other words, if Mexico at some point hypothetically was able to deal with these problems and become a modern liberal democracy, like you said, would that make someone like Trump more inclined to be less critical of Mexico, I guess?
It's a really very tricky question that you're asking, because it requires a very refined answer. Number one, I think that Mr. Trump has an animosity towards Mexico because there are some hypotheses that he was not very successful in doing business in Mexico, and that he felt cheated. He might have faced moments of corruption, and he thought that they were impossible to do business with. He might not have wanted to pay off people. Maybe they didn't give him access to the kinds of beaches and places where he wanted to build resorts. Mexico is a very attractive place for that. Obviously, it's been blessed with incredible beaches and real estate that is desirable to the tourism industry and investors of that kind. And so he's not been able to break into that. So there's already kind of a personal animosity towards Mexico. But also, I think he correctly senses that there is a lot of anxiety in the United States that has to do with a very WASP identity of the United States. And WASP means non-Latin. It means non-Spanish-speaking. It means non-Mexican. And so there is a heavy content of racial tension in his political base. And there are two very identifiable groups that can be made the boogeyman in this particular case: African-Americans and, of course, Latinos. And the majority of Latinos in this country are, of course, Mexican-born or Mexican-Americans or of Latin origin, born in Mexico and so on. And so clearly they're an important focal point for his rhetoric. And so there's also a heavy component of that. And also, I don't think he sees Mexico, and he thinks that Mexico has taken advantage of American workers and so on. So it's a combination of issues that he bundles together, and they all add up to a fundamental rejection of any kind of partnership with Mexico.
All right. Last question. I ask this of every guest that I interview where the issue of Trump comes up. Does he make it to a second term?
I would not discard it. I think the possibilities are lower every time. There's a lot of unhappiness. I mean, there's a base that will be there forever and ever. But most Americans are probably going to be tired and fed up of all this dynamic, and there may actually change horses in 3 years. But I would not discard it, because obviously almost every poll and combination of polls thought that Hillary Clinton was going to be the winner. So I would not discard it at all.
Sure. Okay.
15 to 20% was enough to give him the win, right? That was the probability, so it can happen again.
Well, Tony, thank you very much, my friend, for being on the podcast. This has been very, very informative, and we'll have you back at some point in the future to talk when something happens, either when NAFTA has failed, or when the wall has gone up, or when the wall hasn't gone up.
Anytime, and my warmest greetings to your listeners.
Thank you. Thank you very much,
Tony.
Bye-bye now. I don't want you.